Good evening and welcome to this week's episode of Agenda. I'm Ewan Gorn. On the programme tonight, we speak to the island's two homelessness charities, Gry and Housing Matters, about grassroots work to tackle the issue. They tell me of a lack of suitable accommodation on the island, what could be done to improve the situation for those without a home, and touch on the recent tragic case of evicted council tenant Ross Ward. The coordinator of Gry has praised the fantastic work taking place at the grassroots level in tackling homelessness, but Michael Manning warns the broader picture still shows rising levels of need. The charity provided 111 bed spaces at its pilot night shelter during the first 3 months of this year. As politicians are busy discussing the definition of poverty with a report expected shortly, I went to speak to Mr. Manning at the drop-in centre at Gry on Broadway in Douglas.
Gry is the Manx word for love. We're a charity serving people who are homeless and in insecure accommodation on the island. So the main way we do that is we've got a drop-in in central Douglas, which is open every day for people to come in, practical provision, free food, clothing, bedding, a shower. We're in the middle of running a pilot night shelter as well, so we offer basic shelter to men or women on the island with nowhere else to go. And then we do pastoral visiting and support within the community as well.
So I should say we're at a drop-in session now, it's going on behind me. What kind of things do people come to you to talk about when you have conversations with people who use your services? What do they say?
All sorts, really. I mean, we can have everything from people just wanting to come in and have a tea and coffee. People wanted to come in and share their whole life story. People coming in all sorts of different states and situations. So whenever we open the doors, we're never quite sure who's going to come in, what state they're going to be, what conversations we're going to have. And so it's certainly very varied. I mean, what we really see is people really value the safe social space that we have at the drop-in, which just means that people can come. It's very non-threatening. We try and make it as unconditional as possible. And people can come share time with our volunteers, build relationships, have a cup of tea and some food, and just a bit of a chat about life.
And how valuable is the time you give? Is that one of the most important things you can offer, is speaking to people?
I think it is. I mean, I think we live in a very busy and sort of stressed and hectic, frantic kind of world, and people and loneliness and isolation across the demographic, across society, are on the rise, aren't they? And certainly isolation is a really key factor, a risk factor for the guys that we have contact with, the men and women that we see, our guests. They often have no other support networks in their lives. And so just to have a space where we're not a service that are put on for them, it's just creating that environment where people are welcome and where we can spend time together. We try and break down as many of the us and them barriers as we can. It's not about us, the sorted people, helping them, the unsorted, as much as possible. It's far more about us meeting together, being able to talk to one another. And that time spent with people is what is really crucial in terms of building trust, building relationship, helping people see hope in the situation that they're facing, and then beginning to look for ways that things can change.
Is giving that time a burden on resource? Does it take a lot of manpower?
It does. I mean, we can only open as much as we do because of our fantastic team of volunteers who give of their time very freely and generously. And that's actually a real key part of the dynamic with our guests as well. They understand that most of the people here are here freely and want to be here and are giving their time to spend with them. And there's a high degree of respect for that. But it does take time. And that's, you know, time with people is always, you know, intensive, and it does take time, and it takes a lot of people to deliver that.
When guests come to Gry, do they see you as a charity service provider? What do you think they see you as?
Again, probably a whole mix of things. I mean, we're quite small, and so sometimes there's quite a bit of fear and anxiety. I mean, we're next to a church building, and I think because we're a Christian charity, sometimes people can think, oh, am I going to have to say a prayer or read a Bible verse before I, you know, have a cup of tea or anything? And we don't do anything like that, and we're not a space where proselytizing takes place at all. We just welcome people of all faiths and none. I think some people come down to us having been sent from other agencies, and so we'll see, oh, these are people who can help with something, something practical. Could be food, could be shelter, could be help with a deposit into accommodation, that kind of thing. Other people will have just heard about us from their friends, their associates on the streets, and will know that we're just somewhere nice to come, you know, where they can get a bit of free food and a space to sit and chat, and people who are going to be kind to them. And so I think there's their expectations vary a lot. And hopefully when new people come through the door, when they see that we're quite informal, we're not the same sort of authority level that you get in lots of more statutory services particularly, and you know, they can see that that's a place where they can come and begin to trust us.
How regular are referrals, and do they make up the majority of your guests, the minority? What would you say is the balance?
I would say it's a real mix, actually. I mean, we've the police regularly bring people down to us. We've had the police bring in somebody in just over the past couple of days. We've got really good links with charities such as Housing Matters and the Salvation Army, with churches and other faith communities on the island, food bank we work with. And then we've got really great links with things like the Adult Health and Social Care Services, the Vulnerable Adult Health Visiting Service, the ASAT teams and mental health workers, that kind of thing. So people come, the benefits, people come from all sorts of different sort of places, as well as just coming in because they've heard about us in some way or another. We had a guy turn up a few weeks ago who'd found us on the internet, which is becoming more and more the case. It would have been more unusual a few years ago. He turned up with a suitcase. He'd been sleeping rough for a number of days, and he said, "I'm homeless and I'm so glad that I found you." So it really is very varied.
How much of an issue for some of your guests or for some of the people you've worked with and given services to, how much of an issue is evictions? Does that crop up regularly? Is that a rare occurrence? What's the relationship like with that particular issue?
I think we're talking about people, broadly speaking, who are at the bottom end of the accommodation market, mostly in the private sector. And so they're living in often environments that are largely unregulated in terms of both quality and business practices of landlords. There are some fantastic landlords out there, and we're getting better and better relationships with landlords. My colleague Erica's fantastic at building those relationships. What we do have is a large turnover of constant sort of evictions. People are moving in and out of flats and rooms very quickly. Often they're given very little notice in terms of evictions. Sometimes there's not very much written down in terms of tenancy agreements.
Does that tend to be the private sector more?
That tends to be more the private sector. We have had some problems, and there's obviously been a lot of publicity recently given to Ross's story in terms of a public sector example of an eviction. But most of the problems that we see are certainly with private sector landlords. And then, you know, tenants, if they've got a bad reputation or if there's been some difficulty with some landlords, then it can be really difficult to get back into any sort of accommodation. So it can be a very shiftless sort of environment for people, really. So people are often moving accommodation quite a lot, sometimes sofa surfing for a few nights, weeks or months here and there, you know, before they're back into somewhere of their own for usually quite a short period of time before they're somewhere else. So it's really quite chaotic and variable.
You chose to publicise Ross's case through the Grey Gazette in some way to highlight. Why do you think it was important to do that?
Two reasons, really. I mean, first was it was something that Ross wanted us to do. And as with all of our guys and our guests that we see, if they're wanting support and we can give it in some way, we're happy to try and do that. So Ross was very keen that his name was on it and that his case was publicised, and we were happy to help him with that. And the second reason, we were disturbed by the situation that had arisen with Ross last summer when he was evicted. And we had seen this. There was obviously a failing in the system somewhere for Ross, that this situation had arisen. And so we wanted to explore that and share that story with you.
So where was that failing in your mind?
The failing fundamentally was in communication. I mean, he was evicted for arrears that should have been cleared. He'd been told that they were going to get cleared. There was a grant that would have been paid by a local grant-making body. He'd been given assurance of that during his time in prison, and that had never happened. Mm-hmm. And so fundamentally, that's where the biggest mistake lay, because that's what led to the arrears that never got cleared, which led to the eviction process. I mean, I think there were potentially other problems in terms of how that eviction process was managed and communicated to Ross, but the biggest failing was certainly that failure to clear those arrears when that had been promised.
So if we were to sit down with all the relevant parties and improve that communication to ensure that doesn't happen, I mean, this is public sector we're talking here, where there are statutory bodies to assist people. How would we improve that? How would we make sure it didn't happen again?
I think it's about building those relationships with, you know, not only with vulnerable tenants, but with support agencies, be that GRI, Housing Matters, the Vulnerable Health Team, Mental Health, whatever it is, you know, building those relationships between them and the housing officers, whether that's from the council or from the DOI or the other housing providers. And I mean, I think there's a sense of the closer those working relationships are, the more likely and the more easier the share of information can be, the more likely concerns can be raised in a relevant way and in an appropriate way, and that vulnerable adults can be protected and made sure that they don't reach the sort of positions that Ross reached. So I think it's about relationships not only between the housing provider and the tenants and those, how you communicate with vulnerable people, but about the communication with other support agencies as well.
Do you think housing providers know how to communicate with vulnerable tenants?
Many of them are fantastic. You know, we have a fantastic relationship with DOI Housing particularly, who have got very skilled housing officers who are great in terms of how they communicate with vulnerable people. I think it'll vary people to people. When you're dealing with people, there are some people who people will get on more with than some who they won't. And so I think, as always, it's about making sure that housing officers feel well supported in the job that they do and make sure that they've got the skills to communicate effectively when particularly with people who might find mainstream modes of communication difficult.
So when you say housing officer or any officer of any charity needs to feel well supported in their work, is that the case at the moment? I mean, is there the resources for officers on the ground to feel well supported?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it varies. Sorry, I mean, it's always a difficult picture to say. I mean, I think what we do tend to see is, for particularly vulnerable people, is that when you're accessing services, be they housing services or any other sort of service, if that service is feeling stressed, if it's under systemic kind of stress, then the workers are often dealing with large caseloads. Housing officers sometimes will be dealing with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tenants. You can't give time, bespoke time, to vulnerable people when you've got a whole load of other priorities. So with the best will in the world and the most wonderful people in the world, you're never going to be able to do an effective job if you're dealing with that level of people. Mm-hmm. And so I think there really is a systemic look at how you best resource time, particularly for the most vulnerable. And we see those stresses in a lot of places within services, which just means that people fall through the cracks. They're not communicated with effectively. They're not getting services that they need. And therefore, there's an increasing suffering and cost.
It's been suggested to me that there should be some sort of body whereby all charities relevant and agencies, government as well, meet together, have a list of, say, vulnerable people that some of them have encountered. They work together to ensure they have all of what they need, essentially, and that nobody miscommunicates in any way. Would you support something along those lines? I know we've got informal groups of that already, but something perhaps more regular.
Yeah, I mean, we're always in favour of anything that we think is going to bring better outcomes for vulnerable people. And I think any ways that can foster sort of collaboration with people who are working with vulnerable people across statutory and third sector is a fantastic thing. I mean, I think there's been great work done over the past number of years in terms of safeguarding and the safeguarding board and their duties and responsibilities. So I think there is a growing awareness that needs to happen. But again, it's resources. It comes down to freeing people to be able to do that, freeing people within services to be able to do that, and building those relationships.
Just moving into a slightly different topic, but do you think there's enough accommodation on the Isle of Man at a certain cost, say hostels or whatever, to ensure there is somewhere as more of a halfway house for certain people that may need something more temporary?
This is one of the biggest gaps that we see on the island. There's absolutely not. And, you know, we see a huge gap. I mean, we've got really at the moment, and for the first time on the island, we've got guaranteed shelter 7 nights a week for men and women. That's only because we're running a pilot scheme at the moment that will end in January 2020. Your basic shelter is really difficult otherwise for people to access. And then you've got public sector housing, which is very difficult for single people particularly. There's 16 housing providers or something on the island, so that's quite chaotic and all with different criteria. And then you've got the private rented sector, which is in some senses at the bottom end of the market, unregulated, very dependent on how good or bad your landlord is. And so there's a massive gap in the middle of what supported accommodation. And supported accommodation is a very broad term for a whole variety of models of supporting people in their accommodation. So that can be everything from hostels, where people are in a staffed environment to maintain stability, get a bit of skills of independent living before they move on to their own place. It could be floating support, where we visit people who are already holding tenancies, private or public, to help them to maintain support in that tenancy. It can be community houses, where you've got people living together, offering hospitality and support to people who are on the margins. So there's a whole variety of models, and what we don't have very much of at all on the island is any of those. And so I think there's a huge gap there, particularly for the most vulnerable. And that goes across all sorts of different sectors, not just people who are homeless, people who are struggling with all sorts of vulnerabilities. I think there's a huge gap there. And so we would have long been saying to anyone who will listen that supported accommodation would be a really beneficial thing for the island. We'd love to see more of it.
So in places where there is support, more support, supported accommodation than the island. Who provides it? Is it charities? Is it government? Is it other groups?
It's a real mix. I mean, and one of the problems, and that's been a recurring theme, hasn't it? I mean, I think in the UK, one of the main differences between the UK and the Isle of Man is in the UK, you've got a whole sort of statutory architecture, a whole legislative architecture around homelessness. There's laws concerning homelessness and around housing, the right to housing. There's legal burdens laid on local councils to provide a response to people who are homeless in their area, all that kind of thing. We don't have any of that legislation on the Isle of Man, so there's no right to housing or shelter and no obligations laid on any statutory bodies. And what that means is it's very, very different. You know, so the main actors at the moment on the island are two very small charities, Grind Housing Matters, in the area of housing and homelessness, whereas in the UK you've got a whole plethora of large and small providers, often working in close collaboration with local councils. So a lot of that is local government funding that's commissioned out to charities and faith groups and such like, other third sector partners. And so there's a whole different ways that can be resourced and funded and modelled. Some of the councils will do that directly, and so it just varies a lot. So
is there scope here, do you think, for closer working between housing authorities and the third sector?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the real benefits of the island, one of the benefits that Gry certainly have found over the years is the fact that we can be very small. We work in a very unregulated environment, and we can work because we're a small charity. We've got the freedom to work very flexibly, and that works really well when you're dealing with vulnerable people. We can respond very quickly to people's needs. We can work in a very holistic way. We're not tied by strict criteria, service boundaries, discharge times, waiting lists, all that kind of stuff. And so there's a great sort of freedom there. And I think if anywhere that holistic working can work well, it's got to be the Isle of Man. You know, we're such a small jurisdiction, and we're not dealing with thousands and thousands and thousands of people in crisis all the time, as you would get in urban centres in the UK. It's surely far more feasible for us to work really well together, statutory, third sector, faith communities, across the whole of society, to make sure that vulnerable people are placed at the heart of what we're doing and make sure that they're given the support that they really need.
You mentioned before in the UK that there are some legislative guarantees in terms of rights to shelter. Would you support something similar being introduced on the Isle of Man? And if it was introduced, how much would it help you?
I think we would support that. I mean, and we've had conversations with government about that in the past. I mean, I'm a very much a results kind of guy. I don't care as much about what's in the law if good things are happening. Now, what we have seen over the past number of years, legislative process can be slow. And so I said, well, maybe we don't need the legislation if we can just do the work, if we can do the good work. My concern is that without the legislation, the work never happens, because if it's not a statutory duty, it's always an easy get-out clause for government to say, actually, it's not really something we're supposed to do, so we can't give resources to it. So I think what legislation does do is it forces our hand as a society to say, actually, we think that people who are homeless, people who are vulnerable, people who are on the margins are important. They're part of our society, and we need to make sure that they're properly supported. And I think when you've got legislation, that's a firm statement about your priorities about protecting the vulnerable, which is something that the government consistently says that it wants to do. So we would be very much in favour of that.
You said you were a results guy and you want to see good things happen regardless of, I suppose, what makes them happen. Yeah. Are good things happening overall, do you think? How do you assess the picture?
I think there are lots of good things happening. I mean, I think there's fantastic work going on within the grassroots. You know, we've got really good links with a lot of health and social care professionals, mental health workers, other charities, and there's great things going on there. I think what becomes much more difficult is when you look at the broader picture. And I think there's a rising level of need that we've seen over the past couple of years. We're still in the process of our pilot night shelter. In the first 3 months, we provided 111 bed spaces to people on the island. And so, you know, it is a very difficult picture. And so I think there is certainly a lot more that needs to be done. By no means is it all doom and gloom. There's fantastic stuff happening. Fantastic things can continue to happen. But we need to make sure that that's given a priority. And I think people who are more hidden, who are more vulnerable, they're always easy to be overlooked. Many of them have been overlooked all of their lives. You know, and I just think it's really important for us as a community on the island to make sure that those on the margins are given priority and given services and access to the justice that they need.
The coordinator of homelessness charity Gry, Michael Manning. You're listening to Agenda on Manx Radio. The second charity directly working to help people with accommodation is Housing Matters. I spoke to one of the group's directors, Don Bailey, about how the charity works for those who need the service.
Well, the first thing is they have to contact us for assistance, but once they've done that, we tailor our approach according to their specific needs and obtain their written permission. We're able to find short-term accommodation whilst we're actually looking for a long-term solution. And Housing Matters can also provide budgeting advice and support service to help them set up in a new home and maintain their tenancy. And finally, we also refer to other charitable and government agencies where that's appropriate to do so.
So you mentioned finding long-term accommodation. How difficult or easy is that on the Isle of Man?
It's difficult in as much that there is a shortage of housing stock generally across the board, which is felt by all the letting agents as well as by ourselves. But because we've established good relationships with landlords, we're usually able to find somewhere.
The quality of that accommodation, are you always happy with it, or do you have to sort of take what you can get?
Up to a point, we have to take what we can get. I can't say we're always happy, but we're always grateful. You know, a roof is better than none, even if it's not an ideal roof.
Do you assist with the payment of rent arrears in any way? I know that's been mentioned at some third sector organisations on the island. Do you sometimes step in?
As a small charity, we're not unfortunately able to do that. But what we can do is help with budgeting and look at ways of maximising what income our service users do have to address any rent arrears. And we can also refer to organisations such as Food Bank, the Salvation Army, or the Manx Credit Union, who may be able to assist.
So how, just curious, of the people who use your services, do you have an indication of how many may have been evicted? Do you?
I haven't got precise statistics on that, but we do keep records in the office.
And just informally, are many evictions, do you know, or would that be too difficult to say?
Evictions are a fact of life, unfortunately. So again, I couldn't put a number on it, but they're something that happens all the time.
How would you describe the relationship between Housing Matters and other housing providers, social services, elements of other landlords? Because you obviously work to find accommodation for people, you know, later on. But how about generally? What was the relationship like? Do you have a good one? Do you communicate regularly?
Well, we have a close and very constructive relationship with landlords and social services, and we're very grateful for that. It makes our job easier.
So is that landlords, private and public sector?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Are there any differences between the private and the public in terms of how you deal with them and how you speak to them?
Not really. I mean, there are differences at their end, but no, we treat everybody the same with respect and consideration.
And are they both as sort of helpful as they can be?
We find most of them helpful, yes. Yeah. Occasionally, they may have restrictions which make it a little bit more difficult to place somebody, but that's not something that we don't get around.
We've heard the recently highlighted case in the Grey Gazette of Mr. Ross Ward, and that's shown how vulnerable people can fall with the gaps with organisations. What can we do as an island to ensure that things like that aren't repeated? What can be strengthened?
As a result of that, Housing Matters met with Douglas Borough Council Housing to look at ways in which early intervention could be improved and thereby avoid such a tragedy. In all of this, good communication is the key.
Would Housing Matters not expect the public sector housing, which is offered to those at a lower rate to help vulnerable people have accommodation, would they not expect the eviction process to be more sympathetic perhaps in the public sector than in the private?
That's not something I can really comment on. Obviously, the fact that the accommodation is less expensive is most helpful. But eviction processes are really a matter of policy for whoever the landlord is, whether it's public or private, although there is obviously legislation around that subject.
A question that's raised its head when we've been chatting to other third sector groups is communication. So is communication between government and bodies within the third sector as effective as it could be? And if it isn't, how can you improve that?
Well, we all have to live with the new general data processing legislation, and we're actively engaged with government and other third sector agencies in trying to establish data sharing agreements.
Does that GDPR legislation make sometimes the transfer of information difficult between groups?
It can hamper it, yes. Mm. I think anybody would accept that's a fact of life, but it's there for a reason. to protect people and to protect their data, and we just have to work with it.
Does your criteria for who you'd like to assist, how does that compare to say, other groups? What is the criteria for those you're looking to help, firstly?
Well, I can't really say what the criteria for other groups is. That would be for them. But as far as Housing Matters is concerned, anyone who gets in touch with us, by the very nature of what we do, we regard as potentially vulnerable.
Yeah, another charity I spoke to, actually the Salvation Army, have suggested more regular meetings with the third sector and government, where perhaps you'd have something like a list of vulnerable individuals that maybe one, two of you are helping, and you go through that to assess what support can be offered between all the various groups. I mean, on the face of it, do you think that's a good idea?
All our cases we regard as personal, and so any meetings with outside agencies would require the permission of the individual concerned. But if that's given, then we would welcome any meetings that help that individual.
And this is a question that has been raised already by Michael Manning, who's talking to me about the housing situation. Gry have a night shelter at a pilot, but he talked of a lack of sort of cheaper accommodation, hostels of this kind that can be of great assistance to vulnerable people. Do you believe, as Housing Matters, that we need more of that?
Well, currently the only emergency overnight accommodation is the Gry project, but it's absolutely certain that we do need a permanent hostel on the island, not only as a place to sleep at night, but also as somewhere to go during the day. And it would serve the purpose of providing an address for people for example, doctor's surgeries. It would also give them somewhere safe to house their belongings and keep themselves warm and dry.
One of the directors of Housing Matters, Don Bailey. That's all from tonight's programme. We'll be back with more from Agenda next week, and you can listen again to this episode online as a podcast. But for now, gurumayu, and have a good evening.